Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
There will be headwinds kayaking the Northwest Passage. Mark Agnew was part of the first team ever to kayak the Northwest Passage, spending 103 days in the Arctic. It is an infamous route between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. It was quite a monumental task, and I'm delighted to say that Mark joins me live. He survived it, spoiler alert. I'm delighted to say that Mark joins me live on the line from somewhere, presumably off the Bering Strait. Mark, good morning to you.
Good morning. Nowhere as exciting as that, just sunny old London.
Fair enough. For those who don't know what area we're talking about here, by the way, just explain to me what and where.
So the Northwest Passage is the Arctic route that links the Atlantic and the Pacific. You know, if you want to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific, you can go under South America, through the Panama Canal, or over Canada and Alaska and out to the Pacific that way. And that latter one is the Northwest Passage. And for obvious reasons, it's not the desirable route. But as the climate change takes hold, the ice is beginning to disappear. And people have begun to wonder, will it be possible to make it through the Northwest Passage by human power, no motors or sails? And for about 13 years, a lot of the different teams, kayaks, rowing boats, have all been trying to prove the point that they can. And somehow, by luck or stupidity, we made it through. My three teammates and I, the Arctic Cowboys, became the first people to kayak the entire Northwest Passage.
The Arctic Cowboys. Now, I used to have a house on a cottage on a lake over here in Spain, so I had all the toys, canoes, kayaks, etc., and open kayaks. So this is not like so what was your background then in kayaking, and what was this thirst for? Is it a very British thing, because you know the Brits have an affinity with especially the Arctic? So tell me a little bit about why this challenged you particularly, Mark.
Oh, well, there's a few things to cover in there. You know, firstly, kayaking. It will surprise you that I don't really have a background in kayaking. I also don't really have a background in rowing, but I did have some ocean rowing experience, and I wanted to be the first person to row the Northwest Passage. And yeah, I was part of a team, and it all went very sideways. People got very upset about what the money was being spent, and it got very bitter. And it was actually probably the worst moment in my entire life, you know, to realize that my life savings and dreams into that rowing team were just disappearing. And it's something I go into in the book, and I struggle to talk about otherwise without almost crying. But my rival team was a kayaking team, and they had tried the year before in three single kayaks and hadn't got very far. And they thought they could solve some of their problems by going in double kayaks. So that meant they needed a fourth person, and it all coalesced at the same time as my team fell apart and they needed a fourth person. So I called these Americans, Texans, hence the Arctic Cowboy name. And they said yes, and I did two long weekend training courses in Cornwall, and then flew to the Arctic. It was the first time I met them. The day one was the furthest I'd ever kayaked, and so it was really a baptism of ice rather than fire.
Yeah.
But and it was and it was a problem to begin with. You know, my experience, I was significantly slower than these like record setting kayakers, but with their patience and coaching, I got up to speed quickly. But never as quick as them. But so that's how I came to it. But why the Northwest Passage more broadly? As you say, it is a uniquely British obsession. You know, I guess like back when we first started to think about it, it was like an economic thing. The Spanish owned South America, and we wanted, and the Dutch owned the tip of Africa. So if we wanted to get to Asia, well, we had to find a different way. And the first person to send somebody explicitly to look for them was Henry VIII and then Elizabeth I. But in the 19th century, that's when loads of British started to go. And the most famous being Franklin, who's now got the BBC show The Terror, the Michael Palin book, The Erebus. And they ended up eating each other because they ran out of food. And we came very close to where they sank. And I thought to myself as we camped on that particular spot, you know, lots of the Northwest Passage is beautiful and grand and intricate and wonderful, but this place is grim. Mm. What a grim place to die. And then about a year later, after we finished, they found the skull of the captain of one of the ships right next to where we camped, maybe a mile away. So it really was exactly where they died.
Oh.
So, but yeah, that definitely like, you know, caught my imagination, those stories, reading them as I grew up. So it seemed like, you know, an exciting extension of all of the stories that I'd been obsessed with.
So you've got two kayaks. Obviously, there's no support team. There's nobody following you behind in a boat, you know, or in a motorized
car. We have a support team in Texas who are sending us texts like tomorrow, weather is good, weather is bad, you know, or even logistical stuff like we need new dry suits. Can you organize them for when we get to halfway and there's an airport and stuff like that?
Right. So you've got, you've got everything. You've got everything in the kayak. There's a 2-man kayak. So what size? I mean, are they
20?
Specially prepared Arctic kayak? I mean, what size? Is there anything special about these ones?
So they're 23 foot. I don't know why it's in feet. What's that in meters? Like
divided by three, and I'm rubbish at maths. That's why I'm a radio presenter.
Long and expensive, like performance kayaks. And then my team captain West then did some like modifications, like. People an electric pump in the cockpit, so if we ever did go over, it could empty in 7 minutes. Like big robust handles, so when we're jumping out of the kayak and trying to pull it up onto the shore, you're not like pulling on the flimsy like rubber handles at the front. We're four people holding onto four iron handles. So a couple of things like that to make it more specific, because 23 foot is, you know, one of the most difficult things was launching and landing.
Yeah,
you know, single kayak, you would like sort of run up on shore and then land and jump out before the next wave gets you. But in a 23-foot kayak, you do that, and I jump out of the front, and Eileen, who's my kayaking partner, is still like 3 meters into the water, you know, so like she can't jump out, and then the waves start coming and the boat gets pushed everywhere, and it was where the boat could get damaged, where we could get injured. It was definitely the hardest thing.
Presumably you're wearing dry suits at this point. You're not going to...
Yes, the dry suits became moist suits, became wet suits as like time went on. People always ask me about the cold. And yes, it was cold towards the end. Mm. Like to begin with, it was over zero, but then it became -5 and -10, which is cold, but it's not that cold. Like -5 isn't like -40 when you hear people going across Antarctica. Mm. But the thing that was cold was we were wet. We just spent the last like 3 or 4 weeks just wet. My sleeping bag was wet. My clothes are wet. When, you know, we'd have to crack my hat because it was frozen solid to like pull it over my head in the morning, put on all of these wet, frozen clothes, and then get into a kayak and warm up by exercise.
Friends of mine are believe it or not, Inuit. Their mother is Inuit and the father is Danish, so Greenland, etc. And that they go kayaking that part of the world, hunting whales. Great idea, but they famously told me we don't bother putting sort of life preservers on our ferries because if you fall in the water, you are going to be dead through the shock and the cold with literally sort of I think it's like 75 seconds. What's the prognosis on for where you were, Mark? Because presumably if you go in the water, you've got somewhat of a problem.
Well, it's a similar place like to them. You know, kayak is an Inuit word, so it doesn't surprise me that they're kayaking. They invented it. I don't think that. I think 75 seconds is not true.
Right,
I think you've got. I think you've got an hour before you're dead,
right?
But maybe 15 minutes before you're useless. So, like, if you aren't able to do something in the first 15 minutes, you're going to be too numb to get yourself out anyway. So there's two of us. And the safety is in us being in a pair.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd have to roll it over, brace against the other team, try and empty the cockpit as you get back in and then get to shore quickly. And most of the time we're sort of hugging shore or close to shore if we're cutting across bays. But the big dangerous ones would be crossings. Like the biggest crossing is 50 miles wide. So at one point we're 25 miles from shore in either direction. And that's those are the most committing, and when you need to wait for the perfect weather and know that you've got buffer on either side, like the weather window has to be huge. And yeah.
And what's the geography like? Cause I'm thinking, you know, obviously I'm thinking, you know, you're going past icebergs or something, but is it coves and bays and places you can get? You're not setting camp on ice floes or something like that.
It's hugely varied, you know, it's 2,000 miles across the top of Canada. So even sometimes we'd leave one island and land on another and it would just be different topography entirely.
Yeah.
And so one of the reasons that we succeeded is we started from sort of the northern end, which meant there was a lot of ice in the water at the start. And everybody else who's tried, including that year, there was somebody racing us to the other end, start from sort of the other side, which is further south. So they can start in relatively ice-free water earlier, quicker, safer. But then when winter begins to creep up on you, they're going north and we were heading into this something. But that did mean that there was a lot of water in the ice, a lot of ice in the water at the beginning. You know, when we launched night one, we launched and it turned into a 14 hours of like desperate struggle, unable to get back to shore because it was just ice everywhere and we were inexperienced, underestimated it. And after 14 hours, including dragging the boats across the ice, we made it back to some cabins where we'd started, so 0 miles. And then we tried to launch again and again, and we were stuck there for 15 days until eventually we said, right, we're just going to go for it, hell or high water, get around this ice. And after 40 miles, a storm came, so we had to get out, and we had to get onto the ice then, but we didn't want to camp on it. So we dragged the boats across the ice. And at that point, it was breaking up and getting lumpy, and the kayaks aren't designed to be sleds. So that 2 miles took something like 5 or 6 hours. And then in the morning we had to do it back, and more ice had moved in, and that was like the pack. That wasn't even like the ice that's like sort of like land. So that was chunks that were bobbing around. So we'd have to jump from one thing to another, sort of like a Mario computer game, and then pull the ice. The kayaks behind us, that took us 9 hours to cover 3 miles. And then we were trying to get to somewhere we could land, and the ice disappeared, but there was still just these huge cliffs coming straight out of the water. And another storm came. We managed to find the last remnant of ice, like maybe a 3 meter wide platform. We pulled out on that, and that was the night we did camp on ice. But then a pack came in and started grinding against the shelf as waves lifted pieces up and then slammed them down. So even though our little shelf started to disappear, so we had to climb up the cliff and sleep on a ledge. And then after that, the next day, we managed to get to a beach and we never camped on ice again. But we did have to get out on it once when two bits collided with us in between, which was the best day. That was the 50 mile wide crossing. Ice came where it wasn't supposed to come. We took about 10 hours to do the crossing. We were 1 hour away from finishing, and then all this ice came in, and it took us another 17 hours to do the final few miles, and the ice came. And everybody agrees that was the best day.
Because I'm going to say that, doesn't that make sort of your logistics very, very difficult? Because you're saying, okay, because if you're doing a down the coast, if you're doing, I don't know, down to Tierra de Fuego, for example, you know you're going to go down this strip of the coast there, you've got rocks there, the whole thing. But if you put ice into the mix, as all my bartending, my mixologists will be saying, you put ice into the mix, it changes everything. So you can't say, we will be, you know, we can kayak at this rate of knots, that means we're going to be here, we can make camp there. If you're throwing pack ice, storms, the occasional iceberg floating by and saying good afternoon, it must make the whole logistical planning really, really difficult.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, a lot of people would ask West, the captain, he would just refuse to answer this question. People, including us sometimes, what does our average need to be? And he's like, you know, there's no such thing as average up there, because like one day is just different from the next. And in the first half, when there was a lot of ice, you know, it could be 40 miles, 0, 10, 30, 0, 25, 30. But then in the second half, when there was no ice, and in particular, when there was nighttime imposing a structure on us, we were like, we can only kayak between the hours of 7 and 7. So let's go from 8 till 5 to give ourselves a buffer of light. And pretty reliably, we're doing 30 to 40 miles every day. But then the variable changed from ice to much worse weather. So like straight out of halfway, we did like 6 days in a row where it was almost 40 miles every day, 40, 40, 40, 35, 40. And then the next 10 days, we only kayaked twice because the weather was so bad.
Yeah.
So like, you know, it was indeed, as you say, like all of the variables imposed on us made like any sort of regular pattern just difficult.
Presumably the sort of hanging around, the waiting, if you're stuck on these for like 10 days at a time or something like, because the weather's too bad, that must be, because I mean, it's not like you can sort of sit and go do the Times crossword. I mean, it must be.
We bought a crossword book.
We did, but
it almost became a joke because it was such a bad crossword book. It was like for kids, but, and we had Kindles, so I read my Kindle. But you know, there is this thing that happens like, yeah, being stuck on shore was the worst part, because as soon as you're covering 40 miles, I'm beginning to daydream about my return party and everything like that. But then as soon as you're stuck, you begin to worry, oh, how many days of food do we have? How many more days? Like the margin. So it was more stressful. But equally, like when you come off your phone for days, for months, and you've got nothing to stimulate you and your rhythms become natural, like, time just feels different, and it certainly wasn't boring. I read a phrase once, the bliss is on the other side of boredom, and you just have to get through that pain of boredom. And then like, you know, you'd be lying there all day and I'd say, God, it's 4 o'clock. I'm maybe not out of the tent yet. No, everybody says, I can't believe it's 4 o'clock. What have we been doing? We're just sitting here thinking, and it's like meditative. And we'd kayak for 10 hours and sometimes not speak for hours at a time. And you're just like in your own mind in a way that, it's not just like meditation. It's unless you experience it, it's difficult to relate to or explain, but there's like a different natural circadian rhythm, which we just don't experience when the stimulation is just at our fingertips the whole time.
Yeah, the other thing is the fact that as well as that, it's if you're in such an alien environment, you know, in a 24/7 world in which we live, the information over it, and you're there. And the piece that, I mean, you know, like I said, I spent time in the Sahara, and the thing that, right, you know, and the thing that freaks a lot of people out is the sound, because you can hear the blood pumping in your ears, and it's that complete lack of something to occupy yourself. And so getting ready for lunch will take you most of the day, sort of thing. And it's that time for reflection. But if you're up there in this alien environment and there's stimulation, and you know the history of there, you know those expeditions that have gone so terribly wrong, is there almost a feeling like you could almost be traveling through time, Mark?
So one thing that I noticed, particularly when we were preparing for that 50-mile crossing, because it was probably the most remote part, is, you know, of course I've been in places before where from an ocular sense, there's nothing around. Like even the Scottish Highlands, you do a big 360 and if I did a panoramic image, it would be as wild as the Northwest Passage, or even offshore in an ocean rowing boat or a sailing boat, not being able to see anything, like you're by yourself. But there was something that like, on a cellular level, deep within, that was aware of the fact that even beyond the horizon, it was empty. And it was, there was something that allowed me to just acknowledge the vastness. And not like, aren't I privileged to be here, or any kind of active like reflection. It was just like a feeling where I was like, I am really, really alone here. Ironically, that was the only place we saw anybody. We came across like a bunch of beluga researchers, and they gave us some food and a pack of hobnobs. So it was like the irony of being like, yeah, in the most, wow, I am truly alone. Oh, look, hobnobs. but equally, it was just like a kind of a feeling that's difficult to put your finger on.
How about the physical demands? Because we all think about, you know, people might think, oh, kayak, it's just basically paddling. It's like taking a rowing boat on the Serpentine. It's a little bit different to that. I mean, how do you adjust to that over the period?
So I thought we'd have a lot more injuries. I thought we'd have a lot of niggles, but, you know, we didn't. But towards the end, I was holding on by my fingertips, you know, 40 miles a day, every day. It's like kayaking from my house to Brighton every day. And but towards the end of each day, I was just holding on by my fingertips, knowing if I finish, then I'll be refreshed tomorrow. Day after day after day, and I'm getting so hungry as well. And particularly me, I was very self-conscious of like the fact that I was the slowest kayaker. And, you know, we had a bit of a conflict over it at one point because I was annoyed about something else. And somebody said, you know, along the lines of like, well, I make concessions for you every day. You got to make them for me. So from that moment on, I was like pushing myself at a level that was not sustainable. And eventually caught up with me, but I couldn't believe I managed to maintain that effort level for almost 2 months before it finally got to me. But so I was like really pushing myself to try and just go as fast as I could. And it did take a toll. It was like everything was burning.
What about the final straight then, when you're into the last? I mean, was there a designated finish point?
So yeah, there's sort of two finish points, I suppose. There's like the end of the Northwest Passage as defined by the International Hydrographic Association, which is this particular peninsula. So it felt like a very specific point. And we were coming up to it, and then suddenly we were in these breaking waves, really advanced kayaking conditions, way beyond what somebody of my experience should have been in. We wouldn't have ever gone out and those, had we seen them, they just appeared. You know, there must have been a shoal or something. So the final 30 seconds were intense, absolute concentration, life and death stuff for 30 seconds. You know, it never, ever got easy. And then in the final 30 seconds, it got as hard as ever. It was like nothing was for free. And finally, we burst out past the end of the peninsula into the calmer water. And I just cried and cried and cried, like shook with tears. It had taken me like 8 years of dreaming, losing my money to the rowing team, all of the tribulations of the actual expedition. You know, to do it, just to cry and cry, was fantastic. And then kayak for another 5 hours to try and get somewhere. We were supposed to go to a village called Tuktaak. It took about 160 miles away, but it was so late now that we were running out of food and the weather was turning. So we went to an abandoned airport. It took us another 3 days, and it got picked up by an airplane that was so small we had to saw the kayaks in half to fit them in there.
Good grief. You know, I mean, it's a silly question, isn't it? But I mean, that this is a sort of, well, it has been a life-changing experience because you now lecture, you talk, you advise people because you've kind of been out there on the ragged edge, to put it mildly. So when you came back from there, I mean, you decided that you're going to use the skills that you'd learnt to hopefully inspire others?
Yeah, so now I'm a corporate motivational speaker. If you have an away day or conference, I'm the one who comes in and tells you, you could be a better accountant if you listen to this guy about kayaking. So I suppose all of the major changes for me happened before. I tried to row the Atlantic twice, and I said I was going to set the world record, and I got rescued 2 days in and then 3 days in on each one respectively, which is embarrassingly close to shore. And that was like the second one was my fork in the road. You know, am I going to do another one of these? If I am, I've got to be seriously sure about why I'm doing it. And I've got to protect myself from having this kind of mental fallout that I experienced afterwards, where I was completely rocked because I have this idea of myself as Brazilian hardcore adventurer, blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't living up to it. And the big shift was I'd become so focused on the outcome, on the world records or the world firsts in the case of the Northwest Passage, that I'd like completely lost sight of what it was that I wanted. I wanted to be an adventurer, which means going on an adventure. It doesn't mean having a world record. Like, it isn't defined by the last second. So I had to really focus in on what it was that about the experience that I wanted. And ironically, when I focused on that, when I focused on enjoying the adventure, getting everything I wanted out of the day-to-day experience, I was happier and hardier. And I went the next day and the next day and the next day, not because it drew me closer to the end, but because it was the experience that I wanted. And ironically, lo and behold, I got closer to the end anyway. So it was like by letting go of the outcome and then focusing on like what it is that I love about the process that made the end possible. And like the flip side is if you focus on the end, then the process is just like a necessary evil. And yeah. you can go through a necessary evil every now and then, but sooner or later, you're just going to burn out or be miserable or unfulfilled. So, you know, and sure, I would love to do something else again that like involves some kind of big objective, whether that's a record or a first or just a personal goal. But like, so the pushing of myself to get to that facilitates all of these wonderful experiences, which for me is about being immersed in nature and having camaraderie.
But you see, you know, you're pushing yourself. The book, presumably this is a discipline you hadn't sort of considered before. I mean, how difficult was it to put the book together?
Well, I was a sports journalist, an adventure sports journalist for, I lived in Hong Kong and I was the founder of the adventure sports section for the national newspaper out there. So writing wasn't a million miles away from me. And, I was already starting on the book before I went, because a big aspect of it is I reached out to psychologists and sociologists and people and interviewed them before the adventure, saying, how can I be more resilient? And I thought they were going to tell me, get tougher. These are the ways you get tougher. But they told me, what is it you really want? Like, what are the intrinsic ways that you measure adventure? Like, one of them gave me this framework, this performance, experience, and relationships. And you're focused on performance. What about experience and relationships? And just as she said that, I thought, you know what? I wanted to be an adventurer because of the experience of being in wild and because the relationship, the team aspect, the performance. Like, I'm not a particularly gifted person, like athletically or any of that. I don't know why I ended up thinking about world records. It's ridiculous. So that's a big aspect of the book. So I already knew the book was, I was going to write the book before I went. And, and then it came quite easily afterwards, because when you have 10 hours a day to sit quietly and think to yourself, I spend a lot of the time thinking, how am I going to tell this story? How am I going to phrase it? How can I explain this to other people? So by the time I got back, it sort of flowed.
And what's next then in the pipeline? Are you planning any more adventures, or is it better just getting the message out there as kind of thing? And I'm not saying, you know, throwing accountants up the North Pole, although someone said that's pretty good place for them. But, you know, what's the next challenge, Mark?
Well, I have my third child arriving in a few months.
Oh, so, blimey. Well, that's it then, basically. Yeah.
In the Northwest Passage, I went while my daughter was one and my wife was pregnant with the second one. So there's limited brownie points to be spent. And, you know, I don't necessarily want to, like, I always say that I'm not pursuing happiness, I'm pursuing fulfillment. And I get fulfilled by these challenges. And then happiness comes as a byproduct. And currently I'm feeling very fulfilled by parenthood. So I don't have that drive, the do it, be all or end all that I had and had to have to do this. But I would like to do something that's maybe 2 or 3 weeks long, much. We're not going to like lose all of my savings over it, potentially lose my life and go away for 4 months when I have 3 kids. So
yes,
there's things circling in my mind, but I haven't raised them to my wife yet.
Yeah,
That's because I know she'll say yes, and I don't feel like it's fair to put her in that position yet.
I could talk to you about this until next Friday, but unfortunately, I only got 20 seconds left. The book is called There Will Be Headwinds. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Just click on the front page, and a well-known distribution service will be bringing it to you. And if people want to find you online, presumably, adventureagnew.com, yeah?
AdventureAgnew.com's website is the same for Twitter and Instagram.
Mark Agnew, I'm going to run out of time, but thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.